This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. A special pledge edition of the Florida Roundup this week.
Today, after all the votes have been tallied, health insurance reform becomes law in the United States of America.
President Obama in the White House, March 2010, signing into law the Affordable Care Act. 3.5 years later and one Supreme Court fight led by Florida later, one of the biggest provisions in the new law approaches. The individual mandate requiring most Americans to have health insurance is scheduled to go into effect in January. So on Tuesday, October 1st, next week, open enrollment begins for the state health insurance exchanges designed to get people to sign up for health care coverage. Now in Florida, like in 35 other states, the federal government runs the exchanges, not the state. WLRN Miami Herald reporter Gina Jordan is in Tallahassee. Gina, Florida really led the effort against the Affordable Care Act. It led the effort that took this case to the Supreme Court. Is the state ready?
Well, I think the state is ready in that there really isn't a whole lot for the state to do at this point. Any Floridians who need insurance can start shopping online next week at healthcare.gov. And navigators that have been hired through federal grants will be all over the state helping folks who have questions. So really, this is going to go forward in spite of efforts by state leaders to block it.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that the state really doesn't have a whole lot to do. Has it absolved itself from implementation altogether by essentially saying it doesn't want to play a role in these so-called state exchanges? Instead, these state exchanges have been set up through the Health and Human Services Agency of the U.S. government.
Yeah, for now, it would seem so. I mean, the state really has abdicated its oversight of health insurance rates under the ACA. It's done that for the coming 2 years or so. It's leaving it up to the federal government to review rates. And of course, we know that the feds don't actually have rate setting authority, which is kind of strange. But anyway, at least so far, it looks like the state really isn't doing anything. The good news is that estimates of the rates that we've seen so far make it appear that they will not be outrageously expensive.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the pricing here in a moment, but kind of back to the state role in all of this, because, you know, Governor Scott, just a matter of a few weeks ago, as we were marching toward this October 1st open enrollment season for the Affordable Care Act, had raised questions about privacy concerns, and also the state health department moved to ban these so-called navigators, folks that are trained to help the uninsured navigate through the ACA health plans and the state exchanges, ban those navigators from county health departments, although Broward County and Miami-Dade County have stepped up and said, no, they're welcome.
Yeah, the state leaders have said that this was a privacy issue, that they don't want these navigators around people who could be turning over their personal information. They said, you know, we don't know what they're doing. So the Florida Department of Health ordered the county health departments to ban navigators from their property. And it turns out that the counties actually own these buildings in a lot of cases. And so several counties have said, no, we're going to ignore this order. But the state really contends that this is a privacy concern. The governor's office is quick to point out that a congressional committee did say that you cannot verify a certified navigator from a scam artist. But really, the navigators are supposed to be there just to help. They're not supposed to be gathering any personal information and walking off with it. They're really just there to answer questions, help people shop, and help people apply for coverage.
What's really at heart here? I mean, is it the matter of state policymakers dragging their heels, kicking and screaming, despite the implementation of the ACA, or are there bona fide concerns? I mean, you know, navigators, the so-called healthcare navigators, are used with other agencies to try to assist folks in signing up for these kinds of programs.
Yeah, that's true. If you get Medicare, if you get Medicaid, if you're on Social Security, there are people who are there to assist you. And the idea is that these navigators are very similar. The state, you know, maybe this is a genuine concern about privacy. Maybe this is just another step of them trying to keep the Affordable Care Act from happening. But the bottom line is the federal government has paid for these navigators to help people, and they're going to be all over the state to offer assistance.
WLRN Miami Herald Tallahassee reporter Gina Jordan with us along here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. All right, Gina, let's talk about where the rubber meets the road, the pricing and the plans. What can the uninsured, or even the insured for that matter, they can still shop for these plans as well. What can they expect on Tuesday?
Well, Tuesday, the marketplace officially opens. You can go online right now to healthcare.gov and you can get yourself an account. You have to have an account before you sign up anyway, so you may as well do that now. And then you can start shopping for basic coverage if you want. That would be a bronze level. Or you can maybe add a little coverage, go up to a silver or a gold level. Or maybe you want the priciest, best coverage, and that would be a platinum level plan. So all of that will be available starting Tuesday online, and you have 3 months to shop before the coverage goes into effect in January.
And what do we know about how the Florida pricing is shaping up with other state exchanges across the country? Because what we don't really know, and this has been a critical complaint, right, Gina, is that the we don't know what exactly are in those plans. Some of the pricing has been released, but not necessarily the specifics of the different levels of plans.
Yeah, exactly. Right now, we really have no idea what we would be getting. But it looks like right now that Florida residents might pay a tad more than the national average, but there's such a wide range. Like the guess right now is that if you're a Florida resident and you get the most basic plan, it'll cost you about $250 a month. That's just kind of a guess, and it really depends on where you live because geographic location plays into this as well. But Florida, it's pretty comparable to the rest of the country. Again, maybe a tad higher overall.
Yeah, maybe comparable, maybe a tad higher. But the number of uninsured people in Florida is also higher. It's the second largest state in the nation in terms of the number of folks under the age of 65 without health insurance. How is the state, do you think, in Tallahassee and policymakers on the state level going to be assessing the relative success or failure of the ACA over the next several months during open enrollment, perhaps more importantly during 2014?
Well, I think that at this point, leaders have to admit that they thought this law was never going to make it this far. And so now they're sort of stuck and they're going to have to say, okay, well, if 25% of Florida residents don't have insurance, they'll be looking at the money. They'll see how are we being impacted. There's been a lot of concern about skyrocketing premiums under this. But over the next few months, they'll be able to get a close look at who is signing up, how much they're paying, and they may come to realize that this is a good thing for the state's bottom line.
Yeah, it's an economic issue in that regard. It's certainly a community issue in terms of health care and the health of our broader community. And of course, 2014 being a political season here in the Sunshine State, also a very significant political issue. And that's why we've got WLRN Miami Herald Tallahassee reporter Gina Jordan with us, joining us via Skype from Tallahassee on the Florida Roundup. Thanks, Gina.
You're welcome.
And we'll have more on the eve of Obamacare coming up Monday morning at 9 a.m. on the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN Health Insurance in South Florida. The Florida Roundup is still to come here on this Friday. The state wants to drop out of the testing system for Common Core. It is the Florida Roundup on WLRN, a pledge special edition. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. This week, Florida Governor Rick Scott said he wants Florida to drop out of the testing system designed to assess Common Core. That's the group of education attainment goals for public schools. WLRN State Impact Education reporter Sammy Mack joins me here in the studio. Sammy, what did the governor do this week?
Well, the governor issued a couple of letters and an executive order saying that he wants to end the fiscal agent relationship with PARC. PARC is the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers. It's sort of alphabet soup. But basically, this is the test that was being designed by 18 states, and Florida was one of the leaders on this, that was going to be the test that measures or assesses whether or not kids are reaching the Common Core standards.
This was eventually going to replace FCAT.
Yeah, that's right.
As all public school parents and kids know in the state of Florida, FCAT is that assessment test given every few years to see how kids are doing, how they're measuring up amongst themselves, but also between schools and between districts.
That's right. And FCAT is going to have its last testing session this year. And theoretically, by next year, we would have a different test. And for a few years, that different test that was going to replace it was going to be this PARC test.
Right.
But as of this week, that is completely up in the air.
And you mentioned the order that the governor gave was to drop Florida from the fiscal agent, because Florida was the one with its holding the purse on this one.
Yeah, Florida was holding the purse.
Florida had the cash for this.
That's right.
Well, but it wasn't Florida's cash, per se.
Yeah, it was this consortium, this group of states who got together and said, we need a test so that you can compare kids in one state to kids in another state. Got together, started designing this thing. A few years ago, they got $186 million. This was when Charlie Crist was governor. They got $186 million of Race to the Top grant. Mm-hmm. And Florida was the state that was put in charge of managing the money if there was a, you know, request for some sort of service or something that needed to be paid. Florida was the one who was keeping the books.
Sure. So what happens to that money now?
Another state or a nonprofit associated with PARC will probably end up.
So that's the money question. But the testing question. You and I sat in these same chairs in this studio on the first day of school, August 19th, and spoke with Robert Runcie, the superintendent of Broward County Public Schools, and Alberto Carvalho, the superintendent of Miami-Dade County Public Schools. And we spoke about Common Core, and they both expressed a lot of frustration that FCAT is the system in place now, and they don't know what's coming up next, and they don't have a lot of confidence in the state ability to assess the attainment or the road toward these goals. And it seems like what the governor has done perhaps puts us on another track, or at least stops the progress that we've seen here on the PARC assessment for the Common Core attainment.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of criticism in the past few days from folks who are really concerned that Florida is actually going to be able to get a new test by next year. Pam Stewart, who has just been appointed the new commissioner of education for Florida, held a press conference this week, and she was adamant that she had faith that Florida would have a new test by the time they needed a new test, that it wasn't going to be the FCAT. And she did say that we are not going to put a pause on this, and that something, she had faith that something was going to happen. Now, not everybody else has faith that that's going to happen.
Well, because history has shown, for instance, just the lack of ability on the state to have firm guidelines and firm metrics in place that that educators know that they're trying to go after.
Right. And this isn't just about whether or not we're going to have a test, because tied up in testing is school grades.
Yep.
It's teacher performance. And so there's a lot more riding on this than just knowing whether or not our kids are achieving educational standards as well as somebody in Alabama or New York. There's more riding on this in the state than just the test.
So just so we're clear on the kind of the procedure, the development of this Common Core attainment test, the so-called PARC, that will continue, but without Florida's input and without Florida participating.
Correct. And Pam did say that if we open this up to a bidding process where we're looking for new tests, PARC is welcome to be one of those tests, and it's not completely off the table, but it also means that if we're not part of that process, then Florida has less of a say over what happens in it.
And there's been a lot of questions in regards to the profit motive with the testing of Common Core. Did the new education commissioner address any of those questions?
She didn't talk so much about that, but there are a couple of other avenues if we don't go with PARC. The folks behind the ACT and the SAT are coming up with their own tests. There's some talk that perhaps Florida would redesign the FCAT. I don't know how realistic that is at this point, but there's a lot of money to be made and a lot of money to be lost on these
and
things.
And the ACT and SAT, those are kind of college preparatory tests. It's not necessarily, obviously, for fourth graders or for ninth graders, for that matter. It's not throughout the system, as opposed to something that's more for post high school.
Yeah, these are people who do have a lot of experience and a certain degree of controversy associated with them about preparing assessment tests.
Right.
So they have in-house folks who are involved in research and development of these sorts of things. There are a lot of questions that haven't been answered, and it sounds like we're gonna have a few more months before they are.
I'm going to leave the question of what your SAT score unanswered for the moment, at least, Sammy. I will not expect an answer. WLRN State Impact Education Reporter Sammy Mack with us here on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Join the conversation. Give us a tweet using the call sign at WLRN. Now, at the United Nations this week, the annual gathering of world leaders did not see Venezuela's leader take the global stage. Nicolas Maduro had been scheduled to speak at the UN, a forum that his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, never failed to use to provoke and poke at his colleagues and his enemies, for that matter. Maduro was a no-show. Tim Padgett covers Latin America for us here at WLRN. Tim, first of all, it seemed to catch a lot of folks off guard that he didn't show up.
Well, yes and no, because he did cancel his trip to New York, but his reason was sort of very what is becoming very familiar to those of us who watch Venezuela. He claimed that there were just too many reports of assassination threats that he was facing in New York, and therefore it was just too much of a risk for him to go there. But as I said, this is becoming a recurring theme.
Yeah.
Maduro responds to every problem with this sort of, well, what's becoming a rather paranoid assertion that he's facing death plots.
And we've seen a lot more Western media coverage really questioning his leadership ability and becoming a really minimized leader, cannot get out of the shadow of Chavez.
Right, and I recently wrote about this for WLRN.org. Jim Wiss of the Miami Herald had a good article this morning. Let's remember, this is the president who controls the world's largest oil reserves.
Right.
And the risk that he's running is that he's sounding genuinely unhinged these days. And the reason, I think, is because he's decided it's the only way that he can distract Venezuelans and the rest of the world, not only from Venezuela's metastasizing problems, 40% inflation, yeah, massive power outages, South America's worst murder rate, but also from the fact that he seems incapable of confronting them.
Certainly incapable of confronting them on the global stage, as he had the opportunity this week at the United Nations. And of course, in advance of that, here in South Florida, we heard this.
Que ellos no hayan podido sacar a Fidel Castro no quiere decir que nosotros no podamos sacar el régimen que tenemos en Venezuela.
Enrique Capriles, the opposition leader in Venezuela, who was making a trip not only New York and also came here to South Florida. You were there at the events. Tell us about it.
Well, he came to Miami essentially to rally the very large Venezuelan diaspora that we have here, which is roundly opposed,
yeah,
to the socialist revolution in Venezuela. But he also came to convince that diaspora that he is the guy that they should be supporting to challenge Maduro again when the next presidential election comes around in 2018.
In advance of this, we spoke on a Florida Roundup just a couple of weeks ago, looking toward his appearance here in South Florida. And I remember we had a conversation in regards to how little political this performance or this appearance was supposed to be. This was more about kind of leadership ideas. Was it political?
It turned out to be quite political. In fact, I spent some time with Capriles. I even sat on this sort of press panel on what's called Capriles TV. It's his internet TV network that he sort of created as a way to get around the fact that back home in Venezuela, the government really doesn't let him have much FaceTime on real TV.
He's blacked out.
And I had some time to talk with him, and when I did ask him about his own candidates, et cetera, he talked a lot about Venezuela's problems, but not very specifically about his own alternative project to solve those problems.
Yeah, he didn't offer up the alternative at this point.
Which is strange, because he I know Capriles from years back, and he does have, I mean, his project is to bring sort of a more third way mix of socialist capitalist system that we see in Brazil, for example.
Tim Padgett covers Latin America for us here at WLRN. You mentioned Brazil, sixth largest economy in the world, but continues to really push back hard on the international diplomatic front against the U.S. and the National Security Administration reports of it essentially tapping into Brazilian communications.
Yeah, we've got to look at this in two ways. The first way, the consensus really internationally right now is that it's one thing for the United States to monitor the communication, the general communications of another country, particularly if you're trying to detect terrorist activity coming into this hemisphere. That's one thing. But it's another to be caught eavesdropping on heads of state, especially in Latin America, where the sort of bitter sensitivity to U.S. imperialism, et cetera, is very high.
Yeah, and it was a scathing speech that we heard from the Brazilian president at the U.N., and obviously that came after deciding to postpone, not cancel, the only state dinner that the Obama administration had scheduled this year, which was supposed to be with the Brazilian administration later on this month.
But we shouldn't take Dilma's indignation so seriously.
Why not?
She's gaining a lot of domestic political points from this that she's going to need when she faces re-election next year. A lot of analysts also say that while they can understand her anger and the anger of other, like heads of state, for example, in Mexico that were being monitored, they think it's a little naive for Brazil to think that powers, not just the United States, but also China,
sure,
aren't also doing this sort of thing.
But in the meantime, does this kind of kerfuffle on the diplomatic side move the public attention in Brazil away from inflation, some
sure
of the supply constraints, and the other economic real concerns
that have taken root? I've written that, you know, Dilma was facing very serious and often violent demonstrations this past summer against the government. In some ways, this was sort of a political gift dropped into her lap.
Tim Padgett covers all of Latin America and the Caribbean for us here at WLRN. You can read his blog posts at WLRN.org. This is the Florida Roundup. I am Tom Hudson. And still to come, the charges to be able to charge a taxi fare in Miami-Dade County and when a Fort Lauderdale street name gets a bad reputation. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. It is a pledge special Florida Roundup. Thank you for listening. Well, for anyone who's gotten into a Miami taxi cab and leaned over and looked in their wallet or their purse and realized they didn't have enough cash, boy, maybe I can charge it. You perhaps have gotten a surprise. There's a charge pushing forward to change that. Ariana Prothero covers transportation, amongst other topics here at WLRN, and she joins us now on the Florida Roundup. Taxpayers in Miami-Dade County, Ari, this week were protesting. For what?
Yeah, some taxi cab drivers were protesting because there's a couple movements within the county commission to require cabs that service the airport, Miami International Airport and Port Miami, to have credit card machines. The reason the drivers are protesting, or some drivers are protesting, is because they're afraid those costs will be passed on to the drivers. And, you know, these drivers, they pay rent for these cars. There are a lot of days they don't break even.
Right.
And they're really concerned about how that's going to hurt their bottom line.
Yeah, the big expense, obviously, is that the charge cards, the banks that issue those charge cards, takes a small percentage of every time you swipe it. And as I understand it, the taxi cab drivers are also concerned about who's going to pay for the maintenance of the machines, let alone pay for the machines themselves.
Absolutely. Installing, maintenance, and those charges. Absolutely. Now, commissioners, a lot of the commissioners said in the last meeting that they really want to try to avoid that, and they want to come up with a deal and a plan that's going to keep those costs away from the drivers.
Right, because conversely, the argument could be made that you're losing on business by not taking credit cards.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot what the commission is looking at. I mean, here's the basic argument that comes with this push for not only credit card machines, but also to require SunPass transponders and GPS and security cameras, is that, you know, the tourism industry is a really big industry in Miami-Dade County.
Yeah,
we've heard a lot on your programs. And the point is that for a lot of travelers, the first people they meet oftentimes are cab drivers, and
right,
county officials want to make sure that first impression that people have with cab drivers and the county is a good one.
Considering how important tourism is to almost every other industry down here, any ability that's going to make it more efficient to separate a tourist from his or her dollars in South Florida is probably something that's going to get a lot of support amongst the business community. But do the complaints you're hearing from the taxi drivers, are they finding any support amongst regulators?
I think that a lot of commissioners are, you know, sympathetic and empathetic to the fact that these cab drivers, you know, often don't break even on a given day, that they have to pay to lease the car they drive. When I listen to the commissioners, a lot of them are really concerned about keeping the costs off the driver and putting it either on the credit card company or the taxi operators.
So the future of credit cards, mandating the ability to accept credit cards, is one taxi cab transportation issue. There's another one afoot here, which maybe is a bit larger and really kind of shaking up this part of this transportation industry. Tell us about it.
Absolutely. So there's this there's a startup company from San Francisco named Uber, and Uber is an app that allows you to book and pay for a luxury sedan car through your smartphone.
Yep.
The issue is Uber wants to work in Miami. They want to have this app in Miami, but there's a lot of regulations that really will prevent the app from working well. For instance, if you book a luxury sedan car in Miami, you have to wait an hour for it to pick you up. There's a minimum fare amount, and there's a limit on how many of these luxury sedan licenses are issued.
Yeah, in other cities, this is called livery service, or we'd call it private car service, for instance.
And yeah, the black idea car is service.
Black car service, and Uber is this technology company that its technology provides this transportation service. And the two regulations you mentioned are really the ones that have kept it from operating in South Florida. One is you have to book your reservation for this service at least an hour in advance.
Yeah, and they say that's too inconvenient. People aren't going to use the app if that's there.
Right, because folks, let's face it, if we're all using our smartphones, we expect immediate
yeah,
service.
Instantaneous,
right?
Absolutely.
That's the whole reason, I suppose. And the second regulation is the minimum fare, or the minimum fee, essentially. I think it's $70.
Yeah, now, and actually, I've heard a couple different things thrown around with that. Commissioners have said $70. I actually just called a limo service,
yeah.
And they said it was actually a 2-hour on an SUV. You actually have to pay for 2 hours, even if you're only taking the car for 20 minutes.
Mm.
So there's been a little bit of...
Maybe that's the company policy,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but the point is that you are gonna, even if you take it 5 blocks, you're going to end up paying a lot of money
right.
for that ride.
So those are the two complaints kind of that Uber has in trying to open up this system. So what kind of lobbying efforts are underway? Where does this debate stand?
Yeah, this has been controversial. I mean, Uber is lobbying the county commission. You know, they have Commissioner Audrey Edmondson has proposed a bill that would deregulate the luxury sedan industry. The taxi operators, the taxi cab companies are not happy with this. You know, they say you're basically going to create this uneven regulatory playing field,
right.
And that's going to be really, you're going to increase competition while creating this uneven regulatory playing field.
Yeah, because on one hand, you've got the taxi cabs that invest in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars in their medallions so that they can be the regulated taxi cab, of which there's only really a few hundred, a relative handful of them. And if Uber has its way, it's able to kind of blow that system up, and it becomes a much more open system, much more market-based system, when these kind of freelance drivers can provide their service on demand.
Right. So the taxi cab owners are saying it's not really free market if half of it's really heavily regulated and the other
right.
half isn't. And of course, as you know, it would. Their claim is that by allowing this to happen, it's going to devalue the medallions. Now, on the other hand, I've talked to several taxi cab drivers who are really behind the Uber initiative because they say it's going to really force the taxi cab companies to be more fair. And I talked to a man named Rudolph outside the Marriott Hotel about this. He's a taxi cab driver here in South Florida.
The fact that the company don't like the black cab is going to be good for the driver. And I repeat it again, something they don't want is good for us. All right? Thank you.
And you know that sentiment seems to be shared by a lot of the drivers I've spoken to.
So where are we on the process of these two regulations? One, forcing certain taxi drivers to have credit card machines, and two, this opening up the black car service.
From the people I've spoken to, it seems like it's going to be a little while yet, but... From my impression from the last county commission meeting on this, commissioners seem really, there's a lot of support, it seems like, right now behind the initiative to put credit card machines in taxi cabs. In fact, they were even talking about expanding it countywide, so it's not just the seaport and the airport. They're a little bit more tentative with the Uber legislation. It seems like there's a lot of confusion among the commissioners about what exactly this app does. Chairwoman Sosa, you know, was asking about, you know, putting out bids for the
right.
app, and you know, there were other commissioners that didn't realize that some of these apps already are, you know, in operation in Miami, even used by taxi cab companies. So it seems like there's a lot more work that's going to have to be done on that end.
You spoke with the CEO of Uber, and I'm curious, does he consider himself in the transportation business?
Yes, he does seem to consider himself in the transportation business, and more so in sort of the county business, too.
All right. So fair enough. Ariana Prothero with us here on WLRN. Earlier this month, a story on our website at WLRN.org featured a new map based on census data that shows just how segregated South Florida really is. And our reporter, Christine DiMatte, has been covering a story. It's wildly interesting, Christina, this ongoing dispute over a Fort Lauderdale street sign. A street sign is the source of this debate and how it's dividing really two very different neighborhoods in Fort Lauderdale. Tell us about this.
Well, you know, Tom, they're not altogether that different these days, and that's the whole crux of the argument. It's about the debate over Sistrunk Boulevard. First, a little history. The whole story examines what happens when a good street name, quote-unquote, goes bad. Mm-hmm. Sistrunk is named after Dr. James Sistrunk. Now, in the 30s, he was the first African-American doctor in Fort Lauderdale. Mm. He opened the first African-American hospital in Broward County. Guy's a hero, delivered 5,000 babies. So to honor him, they named this stretch of 6th Street after Dr. Sistrunk. Now, here's where it starts to get difficult. You have two gentrifying neighborhoods. You have the Sistrunk Boulevard the corridor, mm-hmm. which is a historically black neighborhood, mm-hmm. west of the railroad tracks, which in the last couple of years is starting to really, really build itself up. There was a time it was starting to get known for drugs, crime, prostitution, urban blight, starting to look a lot better. Now, east of the tracks, or more precisely east of Andrews Avenue, you've got another very, very quickly gentrifying neighborhood. And the whole debate is whether to extend the Sistrunk Boulevard name all the way east to Federal Highway, a major artery. Now, the folks on the east side, they don't want the Sistrunk name, not because of Dr. Sistrunk, not because of anything else they say, but because of the name associations.
The reputation because of what had happened years ago.
Precisely. Yeah. They keep coming back to that phrase, negative connotations.
So where does this process stand?
It's at a stalemate right now. Hmm. There was a compromise on the table to co-brand the name. This is done in a lot of cities, to have Northeast 6th Street above in the street name and have Sistrunk Boulevard below. We did ask those folks on the east side what they thought, and we did hear from one of them.
There are just certain neighborhoods people don't want to go walk in and don't want to be in. Whether it's a racial thing or not, I have absolutely no idea. But what I do know is that there's a negative connotation and people don't want it. And those of us who do live here and are trying to develop our neighborhood and improve it would prefer to not change the name.
So is this able to make some progress? Do we anticipate some kind of decision? And quite frankly, what agency does this sit with?
Actually, the Fort Lauderdale City Commission, it rests with them. They've been, you know, playing ball with this, you know, lobbing this back and forth for a number of years. Now they're taking it up again next Tuesday.
Real estate in South Florida is blood sport. Is this a real estate issue? Does this come down to ultimately, kind of the intangible price that some of these lots could potentially be worth?
I've asked residents on both sides that very same question, and everybody's very interesting, Tom. Everybody's very, very reticent about answering that question.
Yeah.
You know, and they say, as much as people say on both sides, that race is not the issue here. I've heard that from both sides of the issue. Race, unfortunately, is the elephant in the room in this debate.
Still active discussions?
Still active discussions, yeah.
All right. More to come next week, right?
More to come
next week. Christine DiMatte covering Sistrunk Avenue and the reputation. Sistrunk Boulevard, excuse me. Thank you for that correction. And the reputation of that here in South Florida. Now, it is election season coming up, believe it or not, and several mayoral races are on the calendar. And we want to hear from you about what local issues matter to you in this election season. Let's phrase it this way. What would you do if you were mayor? We're collecting all your ideas and your stories. You can go to the website at WLRN.org. Answer that question. What would you do if you were mayor? You could also tweet us your answer. Use the handle at WRLRN and the hashtag IfIWereMayor. What would you do if you had that seat of political power in City Hall, in county government? What would you do as mayor? Tweet us at WLRN, hashtag IfIWereMayor, and go to our website as well and let us know at WLRN.org. That is the Florida Roundup here for September 27th, 2013. Thank you for all of our guests for their time, and thanks for listening. If you missed any of the show, it'll be back on the air tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. It'll also be on the website at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our executive producer here at WLRN is Peter J. Maritz. Our technical supervisor is Michael Stock. Thank you, Michael. South Florida Arts Beat is next with music and theater. The artistic director at Actors Playhouse at the Miracle Theater in Coral Gables and the maestro of Miami Symphony Orchestra will talk about their upcoming seasons. That's still ahead with Ed Bell. Stay tuned. Monday morning at 9 a.m. on the Sunshine Economy. It's the eve of Obamacare health insurance in South Florida. This is the Florida Roundup. It is WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
Support for the Florida Roundup provided by the Littlewoods Foundation in support of the highest quality programming to enlighten the public on important issues.